Today, in studio on the Keenest Observers, I have the pleasure of talking to playwright, director Octavio Solis. Octavio Solis has penned over 25 plays and is considered a luminary storyteller known for being one of the pioneers in bringing Latinx stories to the stage and screen. In his 25-plus year career in theatrical work, he's been produced in regional theaters across the country, including the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. He's won numerous fellowships and writing awards, and if you listen carefully, his voice may be familiar to you as one of the cast in the Oscar-winning Disney film Coco. I'll let you see if you can guess which character. Mr. Solis' newest theatrical work, Mother Road, will premiere in next year's Oregon Shakespeare Festival season, and today we talk about his career and the role of the storyteller in Fractious Times, as well as his newest projects. I hope you'll join the conversation today on The Keenest Observers. Octavio Solis, thanks for joining us in studio.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me here.
Yeah, most definitely. Now, I kind of communicated, like literally, your plays have been produced in almost every major regional theater, most definitely on the Western Coast, but most definitely across the country. And not only just large regional theaters, but I think what's very interesting and very, very poignant is in culturally centric theaters as well.
Oh, yes.
And you've won a ton of fellowships and awards as well. What about your background makes you accessible to these spaces from broad to small and...
Well, I cut my teeth on a garage theater. I learned my craft really as a writer. I learned it not only through a university system, but when I got out in the real world, I found out how hard it was to get a role. I really went out as an actor. That's what I wanted to be, but I found that was really hard, especially someone of color. It was just really tough when in a city that was really looking for. More of the type that was that has traditionally been cast in roles in Terry Orchard or Arthur Miller. You know, they didn't cast Latinos in that before, except in the subservient roles, the small roles. So I started writing those roles for myself, and the more I did that, the more I started discovering that I had a voice that I wanted, that had something to say. But the only places that would give me that shot were the small garage theaters. Like the Deep Ellum Theater Garage and Undermain. Those are the companies that I worked with in Dallas initially. But then very quickly, other theaters started taking notice, like South Coast Repertory in Orange County, larger rep houses, the Dallas Theater Center. Suddenly I was a prodigal son come home when I worked 5 years later after I moved from Dallas. I was back there working at the Dallas Theater Center. And then eventually at Oregon Shakes, by 1997, I was already working at Oregon Shakespeare Theater, the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, excuse me. But I never lost my taste for working with those small theaters, the small companies. And in San Francisco, I kept my chops up by working in really adventurous, small black box theaters like Intersection for the Arts in the Mission. In the Magic Theater in San Francisco, out in Fort Mason, and they have a way of keeping me honest. Mm-hmm. And then also working with El Teatro Campesino, mm-hmm. And Teatro Vista in San Jose, they have a way of reminding me of who I am, and that's important. My audience is the American audience, but also there are works that are specifically aimed. At the people of color that I come from, the cultural group I'm from, as a Mexican American.
So let's back up and maybe you can tell us where you're from and how you know you kind of came to your own foundation as a person and a writer. So where are you from?
I'm from El Paso, Texas. My parents came from Mexico, and I was born in El Paso. I was the firstborn of five of us, really, but. I grew up there until I went to college in San Antonio, pursuing a career in theater. I had a fantastic theater instructor that kind of worked with me in high school, and I just fell in love with theater. After my sophomore year, after I did a production of The Diary of Anne Frank, of all things, I was stage bit, and I said, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And I've stuck to that largely. I haven't worked in any other medium. I just started sort of studying just theater. But I had always wanted to be an actor. So it was acting that I pursued, not writing. I still wrote on the side. I wrote poetry. I wrote some short stories. But I thought of those as sort of like completely disconnected from what my theater career should be. Hmm. I never thought of connecting the two of acting, writing for the stage. I never thought of that as something that would happen. It just happened kind of gradually on its own. So I went to graduate school at Trinity University when it was in residence at the Dallas Theater Center. And that's where I also learned so much of my craft as a director. And I took some amazing playwriting courses with some masters of the period. But I did it only because I thought I needed to know how a play worked from the inside as an actor. I wanted to know it as an actor. Mm-hmm. It was sort of sinking in, but it was sinking in a different way. And it wasn't until much later, like 2 or 3 years later after I graduated, that I started realizing that I had some things to say. Mm. I had a voice. Mm-hmm. And it took me a while to realize that. But then it just all started falling into place. And what was even more interesting is that people wanted to hear it. Mm. Theater companies started coming to me and saying, so what are you writing? What are you doing? We're interested in this work. Will you come and work with us on your play here? And I'd never had that happen before.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting because I want to dig deeper into like how you found and what was the seminal moment that made you understand that you had a voice, and what was that voice and content that let you know that?
Well, it was in Dallas, Texas. I'd been writing these plays, and I had cast my students in them, and they were in a punk club and had a kind of punk aesthetic, and they were funny, sort of almost comic book theater sort of thing with music and dance, and it was for the club crowd. But then there was a director named Cora Cardona who had a company called Teatro Dallas, and in fact, Teatro Dallas is still around today. But she came to me and she said, write us a play. We'd like to commission you to write us a play for our company. And she was very specific about it. She said, write us a play set during Day of the Dead and make it about Don Juan.
Okay, we've got to take a break, but that's a great, talk about a like first act break. Yeah. I'm talking to Octavio Solis about his work and his career, and I'm getting into this seminal conversation of the blast off. We'll be right back with the Jefferson Exchange and the Kiedis Observers. Join us. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Robert Goodwin. We're talking with playwright Octavio Solis. You're welcome to join this conversation. Call us at 800-838-3760 or email comments at questions to jx@jeffnet.org. Octavio, we were getting into...
Oh, yeah. We started getting into it. You took me back to my seminal moment, the moment that changed my life as a writer.
Right on.
It was when Cora Cardona and Teatro Dallas approached me and commissioned me. It was my first commission, too, to write a play for their company about Don Juan set during Day of the Dead. And it was going to be with their Latino actors. And they wanted me to write about my culture. Mm. And no one had ever asked me that. And I didn't even know there were other companies of Latino actors. I didn't know there were other Latino actors. I was by myself in this world. And so I constantly tried to think of myself as white so I would get cast as white. And then I saw that I didn't have to when there was a company of like other people like me that all wanted me to write about my culture. Yeah. And so I started to do that. And I wrote about this play about Don Juan set during Day of the Dead. And it was a kind of a comedy that dipped into commedia a little bit. But it dealt with the dual themes that had become my abiding obsession, if you will. Having to do with the twin sides of the same coin, love and death. Mm. Love and death. I see them all interconnected in some way. And it's been sort of moving through most of my work since then. But it also connected me finally to my culture, and I've never looked back. Every play I've ever written has had to do in some way, a direct or indirect, with my... upbringing, with my life, with my perspective as a Latino American in this country, and what it means to be an American as somebody who was formerly from Mexico, whose parents were from Mexico. Even though there are many Latinos who didn't come here from Mexico, but were always here, mm-hmm. after the border was established, they were already here. So I'm writing from so many different perspectives, but a lot of them have to deal with, so much of it has to do with who I am as a Latino American in this country.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to ask you, that question, and what that means to you in terms of like your personal identity, but in terms of your aesthetic and how you, is it intentional for you to weave that into your work?
It is intentional, but also now it just feels like that's there's, how could I not have gone there? How could I not take that approach so naturally before? It's me. Mm-hmm. It's who I am. And if I'm honest, that's where I'll always go. Mm-hmm. If I'm honest with myself, it's part of my identity. And it's not a suit of clothes that I can put on and take off and then put on another costume. It's who I am. And so I write from that perspective as truthfully as I can.
Yeah, I think that that's an interesting walk that storytellers and across discipline walk, is that, you know, to tell and be integrated as part of the American arts community, that there is a decision that artists have to make very quickly about how they decide to intersect in terms of their work.
Yeah, and you know, there was a time when I thought I could have both a writing career and an acting career, and my agent was sending me out to auditions, mainly for commercials and industrials, and I'd get a few things, a few gigs, and I even auditioned, I believe, for the first La Bamba movie. I auditioned there, and I was completely young and stupid, and I didn't know what I was doing. But I had a really interesting moment hit me when I was busy writing my play and I was enjoying it. And then my agent called me and sent me to an audition, said, you have to go there now. You got 30 minutes before you have to go, before you're on. So you have to go there now. And I was so annoyed with her because she was taking me away from my writing. Uh-huh. And I went, all right, I'll go. And I got in my car and I drove there. And I just was like, I was very irked that I had to do this audition. But I said, I'm going to nail it. I'm going to get this. I'm going to nail it. And I went in there and I picked up the sheet that contained the text that we're going to audition with, and it was for some beer commercial. And then I looked around, and there were like 20 other young guys that looked like me, except handsomer, more buff, and they had that hungry look in their eye.
Yeah.
And they were looking at that text, studying it intently, like it was Hamlet's speech, and they really wanted it. Mm. And I thought, what am I doing here? They should go for it. They should get it, not me. It would be an insult to them if I went in there and got the audition, got the role, when I really would rather be writing. And I said, you know what? They can have it. But here's the deal. I'm going to write them the plays they should be doing. I'm going to write roles for all of these young men so that then they can have something meatier for them to work with. So I left it. That's when I turned my back on my acting career and decided I'm going to become a playwright.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's exclusively.
I totally understand that I was visualizing that story as you were telling it. And there is a look.
Oh, yeah.
There's a look in the eye of folks who are really pursuing, you know, whatever their particular, you know, craft piece is. And you have to have your version of that look, or you shouldn't be in the room.
Yeah, exactly, Robert. Yeah. And that's what I saw in these young men, is that they had worked on their bodies, they worked on their voices, they worked on their look, and it's because they're actors. And I understood something about that and how special that craft is, and how I had thought that that's what I wanted to be. And suddenly I found something that I wanted even more.
Yeah, so talk to me about that. So then what did you do?
Well, after that, I just started writing more. I finished Man of the Flesh. That's the play I was working on. It went up. I was surprised that the audience was also largely made up of brown folks, you know. And then, and even more interesting, on the basis of that play, I was invited to participate in Maria Irene Fornes' workshop, the Hispanic Playwrights Laboratory in New York at INTAR. and worked very closely with Irene, who became my mentor. And then also I went in like that summer to work with the Hispanic Playwrights Project at South Coast Repertory, where Jose Cruz Gonzalez, who ran that program, directed my reading or oversaw the direction of my reading. And on the basis of that reading, the play was produced at South Coast Repertory, that same play. And it kind of just, that sort of launched my career. I feel like that's those two moments, one in Southern California, in Orange County, and the other one in New York, those two launched my career. And I was still living in Dallas. So my wife and I realized we needed to make a change. And we said, let's go to California. But I didn't want to live in Southern California because I knew I'd get sucked into the TV and film industry, and I wanted to work in theater.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, we need to stop right there really quickly. Because for folks that don't know this, is that, you know, especially now, the resources, the acclaim to some degree, and most definitely money is connected to TV and film, especially now as TV just blows up in terms of its specificity. That was a huge like decision to say, hey, I want to stay in the theater and write plays.
Yeah, but it was also the 80s, the late 80s, and it wasn't that hot. There wasn't a lot of really interesting programming going on. We're having the golden age of television right now.
You're right. I guess
it started with The Sopranos and The Wire, but it's exploded now, and now because of the proliferation of cable stations and producers, they're looking for material and they're looking for to draw in different kinds of audiences, a larger demographic, a more varied and diverse demographic. So they're looking, and they're looking for good writers. Rather, before, they were just looking for good material. You know, good story or whatever, and then they just would find someone to do the cookie cutter kind of writing. Now they're looking for really interesting writers, and so a lot of playwrights are finding that that's where they go.
Yes,
but that's where they go for their bread and butter. Mm-hmm. It still doesn't mean that they've left the theater. They're still working in theater, but the demands also of writing for television and for film, mostly television. A lot of them go for TV. Means that the rigor of that keeps them very, very tied into the studio and keeps them working a lot. And keeps them working, writing somebody else's ideas, somebody else's story. Whereas I have my own fish to fry, I have my own stories to tell. I've been so selfish and actually I've enjoyed the kind of authority I've had as a playwright. In working on my plays, people are looking to specifically for my voice, specifically for what I'm trying to say, and then trying to honor that. They're trying to do that. Whereas writers are the low people at the totem pole in TV and film. They're there, and they have, you know, these are their ideas that they have to work on, and there's tremendous freedom within that. But they're still doing what the producer is telling them basically to do, what the story creators are dictating. And there's definitely some formulas they have to follow. Mm-hmm. With a long format, though, like with Westworld or other television series, like Atlanta, there is a lot more freedom now with the form, which I find very, very exciting, very exciting. And I feel like, wow, here's where all the playwrights have gone.
Yeah.
They've gone to these shows.
That's why you can tell, too.
You can tell.
Yeah.
Because they're also, they don't observe the cookie cutter form, you know, of how to tell a story in 23 minutes, you know, and if you're doing the half hour format like Atlanta. They're really kind of looking to see how they can break out of that form deliberately from episode to episode. And I find that really exciting, really exciting. Yeah. So each story seems, each segment seems like its own unique little play. And I love that. I love that. If that had been around when I moved to California, I would have been in that.
Yeah.
But now I feel like I've made my bed, and I'm quite happy to be working in this form. And there's very few of us that are still sort of exclusively working in the theater that have been in it this long and are still firmly entrenched in the theater. And without the benefit of Broadway, without the benefit of having gone to New York or off Broadway or whatever, I'm one of the few playwrights in this country. Well, there's a number of us now. It's grown, but I've largely made my reputation on theater in the West Coast, and in Texas, mm-hmm. And I'm quite proud of that.
Yeah, I'm talking to Octavio Solis about his career as a playwright, and we're going to get into his voice in a couple of other projects. Please, you're welcome to join the conversation. Give us a ring or email. I want to, before we jump into your projects that you have currently going on, and most definitely Mother Road, that will appear at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in the next season, what became your voice and how did it connect to the Dallas community, the Mexican-American community, and the community at large? I know we talked about the seminal moment when it began and what that project was, but I'm very interested to see how you conceptualize then what is the thing that pulled like kind of forth through all of those places, if that makes sense.
I'm not sure I totally understand what
you're saying. Well, here's the thing. You know, what I don't want to ask is this the killer question that is, you know, is, you know, for playwrights and storytellers, is there a unifying theme to your personal work? Right.
Yeah.
And we kind of got into that, you know, being, you know, your identity as a Mexican American.
Right.
But about specifically about your stories.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Do you find that there are specific stories that people like to hear from you?
Yes. And there's the stories that keep drawing me back to the same place. I keep going back to my hometown of El Paso. Mm-hmm. I keep going back to the border. La Frontera for me is like a wellspring of stories, so rich. It's like when people think of New York as like, you know, there's a 100,000 stories in the Naked City.
Right.
I feel like that for me is the border. It's complex. The issues are not cut and dried. It's not that simple. There's a lot of gray area. I feel like that border for me, the area north, 100 miles north, 100 miles south of that border, is its own country. It's its own native territory, its own liminal space. Mm. And that, and the people that are forged in that and grow up in that emerge differently. They seem different to me than anywhere else. For me, whenever I go back there, things have a kind of mythic dimension. They take on a larger than life kind of dimension. The archetypes leap out at me, and the archetypes can vary from the great Latin lover to the woman warrior, to the old man who is trying to account for a broken past, who has been broken by that past and is trying to kind of resolve himself with it, to people parted by the river, by the border, and are trying to find each other and themselves by looking north and south of that border. Trying to come to terms with that sort of hyphen that kind of splits people in half as Mexicans hyphen American too, because a lot of us live right on that hyphen. For a lot of us, that hyphen is a kind of scar. And I'm trying to, all my writing seems to kind of drift toward that area.
Hmm. Yeah. I could imagine that, especially being, you know, grounding in place as well as person. Then,
yes.
You know, that's where that's where, you know, all of the personal comes.
That's right, Robert.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's I have like 5 or 6 works that are deliberately, quite specifically set in El Paso. But it's not the El Paso that is really there, because I haven't lived there in a long, long time now. I moved away when I was 18. I go visit my folks there, and I have family there. I go at least once a year, but I haven't lived there in a long time. So the El Paso that I draw on is an El Paso of the mind. It exists inside of me, And that's where I go. So in a sense, by saying I go to the border for my stories, I'm sort of saying I'm going into myself mm-hmm. and into the darker parts of myself to draw out these stories that define me. And I feel like I'm giving, by doing that, I'm helping to define all of us, our culture.
Yeah, yeah, we're going to get into that. We have about 30 more seconds in this segment, and I definitely want to use it as a transition into that same work. I guess that same idea that I see in Mother Road, that'll be presented.
Oh, man.
Yeah, because that's definitely a piece that does that, and it parallels, you know, an American classic with another American classic that you kind of fold in on. And we'll talk about that more in a few seconds.
Good.
But the beautiful thing about that is the marrying. And so we're going to get into that part when we return. I'm talking to Octavio Solis, and I'm Robert Goodwin, and we'll be right back to talk about his work right after this break. We're back with the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Robert Goodwin speaking with playwright Octavio Solis, and we're talking about his career and new play, Mother Road. You're welcome to join this conversation. Call us at 800-838-3760 or email comments and questions to jx@jeffnet.org. So, Octavio, we were getting into...
Oh, yeah. We're getting into Mother Road, the big one.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I've been working on that play for like 5 years. 5 years ago, I did a reading of it at the Steinbeck Center. It had been a commission by the Steinbeck Center in Salinas. After we did this trip earlier, the year before, in the fall, in September, October, I went on this trip with the staff of the Steinbeck Center and two other artists, a visual artist and a filmmaker who brought his video crew with him, including an editor. And we all piled into an RV and a van, and along with a Penguin Books bookmobile, the three of us went on a caravan trip through Oklahoma. We started at far eastern Oklahoma in the town of Salisaw, which is the town that the Joad family is from in the book The Grapes of Wrath. And from there, we took the same journey that the Joad family took all the way to Bakersfield, California, to the Arvin Migrant Camp Center. And all along the way, over that 2.5 weeks, we taught workshops, we broke bread, ate together, we took a lot of notes. We had community partners that set up people for us to talk to and get oral histories, get their stories, and get them on tape as well as on video. And we just started seeing America from a new perspective, rural America, largely rural America, today, through taking the same journey that the Joad family took in Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. And after that 2.5 week journey, we had to respond to it. We had to produce something. And so one of the artists, Patricia Wakita, had a gallery exhibit with 8 to 10 pieces of hers that she made, monoprints that she made based on some photography that she took and some interviews she conducted. The filmmaker is made a video documentary of our journey, and I wrote this play. I wrote Mother Road. That was my response, and I did the reading at the Steinbeck Center's annual Steinbeck Festival that happens around April, May every year. And we did it, and it was fantastic. It went really well. It was very rough as far as I was concerned, but audiences loved it, and there was something there that they connected to. Because I was trying to say something about Steinbeck's time and the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl and the people who were suffering at the time, and making a direct correlation with what's going on today, with the economically depressed small towns all along Middle America, with the new disenfranchised peoples, the new migrant workers, the new Okies, which are the Mexican migrant farm workers. And it was only at the end of the journey that I realized what my story would be when I met this young man who had really long black hair down to his butt and wore a nice, you know, shiny white shirt and some shorts that came down to like half calf and looked totally Mexican and said, "I am the new Tom Joad." He told me, "I am the new Tom Joad. We are the new Okies. And this book is about us." And he's the only one of all the people we talked to who had read the book and who knew passages of it by heart.
Wow.
He was quoting them back to us. So I said, "I think this play is about him." And I'm thinking, what if this young man is really a direct descendant of Tom Joad?
So without spoiling anything, asking folks, most definitely you have to see this work when it, you know, comes to the Oregon Shakespeare Festival next season and beyond, you know, its life as a play. What is that plot synopsis? What is the story about?
Well, the story is about it goes on the supposition of what if there was a Joad that did stay in Oklahoma, didn't go west, but stayed there, weathered the Dust Bowl, weathered the Depression and World War II, and came out fine on the other side, and grew his small little plot of land into a large growing enterprise, a huge ranch in Oklahoma, that after years and years and years, he's still the only surviving owner of it, and he's dying, and he needs to pass it on to someone of the Joad blood, the Joad family name. He wants to keep it in the family. He wants to find an heir to it. And he sends out his lawyer, his almost like a son, his lawyer, out there to find the next heir who will take over this. And the heir finds a direct descendant of Tom Joad in this man named Martin, Martin Jodes, who is actually Mexican. And he can't deal with that. He can't cope with that. He doesn't want to give the land to him. But he's stuck because he's the only surviving member of that clan. And if he really is serious about this, this is who he has to give it to. Martin, on the other hand, feels the same way. Like, why do I want to go to Oklahoma? What's there for me? I don't want to be around that. So they're both kind of at odds with each other about this, but, you know, they're thinking, they're both kind of have their backs against the wall and feel like, well, maybe this is something we need to do. So they take a family trip, and not as a family, as a pair. They're not even thinking of themselves as family, but they are. Mm-hmm. They take their own trip back from Arvin, California, right outside Bakersfield, all the way back to Salisaw, where the family farm is. And along the drive, they meet people and pick up people and have experiences that sort of take them really kind of back in time to where the Grapes of Wrath story really began.
A reverse drive.
Yeah, and the kind of trip back through history, but also through current American history. And so it's a story about like coming to terms with our own past. It's a story about coming to terms with our future, with where we're going to go, how really on this drive, and America's all about the road. How on this drive, on the road, we really have to do it together. There is no other way. We have to do it together because alone it's just going to be fractured and broken. And so I think that's sort of what I'm trying to achieve in this work is how do we do this drive together?
It's a great literal and metaphoric device because the people that are that they meet and bring on are across, you know, different identifications, if you will.
Class, yeah. Gender. They're from very different backgrounds, cultural as well as gender backgrounds as well, and they're people who have kind of been pushed aside, shunted, denied their place at the table, and are finding that they're like, you know, come on, let's go. Maybe there's something there for you too at the end of this road. Maybe there's a way to kind of make things right again. And so they all pile on and they come on. And then when I started writing this, then I started reading the book again and realized, you know, in the book, they start out with this huge American family in this car. And almost as soon as they take off, the very first day, somebody dies. Mm-hmm. And then somebody else dies. Grandpa dies. Grandma dies. The dog gets run over. I mean, and then other family members wander off. Like they say, I can't do this. Go on. I'm fine right here. Just here at this river. You just go on. And then, you know, in the end, the family's all broken up. Even Tom Joad has to leave the family because he's a wanted man. And he has to disappear. And that's where I started thinking, where would Tom Joad have gone? A wanted man. Where would he have gone to live his life? And I thought, Mexico. He would have gone to Mexico. Married somebody there. Had children. Those children had children. Those children had children. And then eventually they came back over for the pizca to work the migrant camps. The fields. To work the fields and live in those migrant camps. And so they're still kind of living the life that Tom Joad was living. Going and picking from field to field, from farm to farm. So that's how I found my way in.
That's brilliant. I'm just going to say it's brilliant. And I think, you know, one of the things as I read the piece as part of my work, my other life as, you know, a staff member at the festival, having to kind of digest the work, one of the questions that came to me was how, as you were constructing the work and paralleling it with, you know, the Grapes of Wrath, how much of, like, present time and the issues of present day, you know, migrant farming, much less immigration, was starting to also kind of milk into your consciousness and inform your imagination?
Well, I've become much more environmentally minded as I've done more research on farms and the people who work them. And so what's in the work is really has a lot to do with what's happening with the farms in terms of the water resources, in terms of overspraying, in terms of how many areas are already starting to develop little dust bowls. There's many regions in Southern California especially that are so parched, so dry, that a little wind can whip up a wall of sand really large. And it resembles those immense storms that hit Oklahoma and Texas, the Panhandle, back in the 1930s. We drove through one. My wife and I drove through one not far from the Salton Sea. That was kind of scary. And I thought it was a rainstorm, but it was a dust cloud. Massive dust cloud that when we drove into it looked like night. It just darkened the sky so immensely. But it's the immigration issues are still present in there as well. In Mo, she talks about people who are her friends who got picked up by ICE in the fields and are now gone, and they were from Oakland. She remembers them very. You know, it's like almost family. And Martin is also assailed as somebody who might not, my main character, my Tom Joad character, is assailed as somebody who might not be legal in this country. So it's very much present. It's very much present. Mm. But it's even more present in my newest work that is on right now called Quijote Nuevo, which is running at Cal Shakes. Mm-hmm. And that's doing really well. And that directly addresses the immigration crisis that we're having today.
Most definitely. And Octavio has you have a ton of work going on.
I think that's
a beautiful thing. You keep moving and keep having work. Mm-hmm. And to that end, you have a book.
Yes, I have a book called Retablos which is a book of stories drawn from my youth growing up as a boy in on the border in El Paso, and I've turned some of these stories into reflections. I've turned some of these memories into reflections and stories that have been collected and will be published by City Lights Publishing in San Francisco in October, early October. And I wonder if I could read one short piece from that.
Yeah, we have about a minute or so.
Good. This is called My Right Foot. I see it on my way out to the airport. The largest equestrian statue in the world. Don Juan de Oñate on his rearing stallion looking larger than even the jet planes that circle over him. A Spanish conquistador who celebrated the first Thanksgiving right at the Pass of the North on the banks of the Rio Bravo. He's the big bad daddy of the town, as omnipresent as the sun, which cuts a deep shadow from his visored helmet over his bronzed eyes. That shadow is his darker legacy of murder and brutality that we're still living down today. Like the blueprint for our future scrolled up neatly in his hand. Oñate and his men put down a rebellion of the Acoma Pueblo Indians in New Mexico, killing 600 of them, and then ordered that all surviving males over 25 have their right feet severed clean off just to make sure they stay put. That was in 1598, but it seems like everywhere I look, people are still hobbling around, walking the slow, hulking walk of the lifelong cripple.
That's Octavio Solis reading from a story that it will be a part of his book that's coming out. Give me the name of the book again.
Retablos.
Retablos. Thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure, Robert. This was very cool. Yeah. I really enjoyed this.
I'm glad you did.
And with my voice, too, which, you know, I've been like trying to soothe after this cold I've had.
I understand. Thanks again for being here.